Good evening, Rachel.
Good evening, Chris. Thank you, my friend. Much appreciated. And thanks for your help for joining us this hour. Really happy to have you here. Through an odd series of events surrounding the profoundly, profoundly criminal presidency of Richard Nixon and the really, really, really criminal vice presidency of Nixon's vice presidency, Ronald Reagan. Through a sort of odd confluence of events surrounding those two national leaders. In the early 1970s, the U.S. Justice Department kind of bumbled its way into stating for itself, putting into writing a new rule. This rule that wasn't in the Constitution in any way. It's an issue that had never really been seriously considered and decided one way or the other before the Justice Department was confronted with it virtually during the Nixon administration. But thanks to this, I guess, sort of odd series of things happening in the months in the early 70s. The Vice President, Spiro Agnew, may be going to prison. The President, Richard Nixon, may be being removed from office against his role in impeachment. Thanks to those things coming together all at once in a big fabulous mess to the American people and American federalism, thought it would be a good idea to organize that party to the White House twice. Thanks to that mess around Nixon and Agnew, the Justice Department in the early 70s had doubled their way into putting down on paper that it was the policy of the Justice Department to not ever bring criminal charges against a sitting president of the United States. And that's like a sort of landmark moment for the Nixon years, right? It's never a good sign of the presidency is so grimy. It forces everybody to slow down and clarify the rules on whether or not you can still be president from inside the presidency. But even though that landmark was abridged during the Nixon years, even though they clarified that rule on paper because of the mess around Nixon and Agnew, that rule, sort of nuts and bolts, never really got tested. At that time, it never really got tested by the events that served the eventual downfall of Nixon and Agnew. Nixon himself resigned as president before he was forced. Not only was Nixon never criminally charged when he was president, he then got a pardon as soon as he resigned, so he was never criminally charged as an ex-president either. So Nixon avoided testing that principle. Same thing with Agnew. They took great pains to not test it with Nixon's criminal vice president, Spiro Agnew, who was running an extortion and bribery ring out of his office in the White House and got caught by federal prosecutors for doing so. With Spiro Agnew, federal prosecutors actually did bring federal charges against him, but they negotiated this very sensitive deal whereby Agnew resigned the vice presidency immediately. I mean, right before, seconds before, he walked into the courtroom to formally face those criminal charges. And the importance of that is that it means technically they never tried to charge Nixon as a sitting president, nor did they ever try to charge Agnew as a sitting vice president. They avoided testing that prospect with both Nixon and Agnew, each of them basically by the same vote. So the rules about not charging sitting presidents were created, they took shape, they were formalized and put down in print during that crisis of criminality in the White House in the early 70s. But that rule wasn't really tested at that time. That rule wasn't really tested until almost 15 years down the road. Until our time in the history books, right for us. It was 3 years ago, 2019, when Special Counsel Robert Mueller completed the report of his investigation into Russia interfering in our presidential election in 2016 to help the Trump campaign. That was what Volume 1 of Mueller's report was about. And then Volume 2 of Mueller's report was about obstruction of that investigation and laid out in detail steps that Trump took as president to try to block that lawful investigation into what Russia did in 2016 and how he did it. When Mueller turned in that two-volume report to the Justice Department in 2019, he said, basically, there's this long-standing written Justice Department policy that says we are not supposed to bring charges against the sitting president, so we're not going to bring charges against the sitting president, but we have nevertheless done this investigation. We've collected all the facts. We've preserved the evidentiary record. So if charges are warranted here because of Trump's behavior, those criminal charges can be brought against him once he is no longer present, once he is no longer protected by that Justice Department rule that says you can't be criminally charged while you're still the vice president of the United States. So that's what Mueller said when he turned in his report. That's what Mueller's report said. Mueller turned his report into his victim, Attorney General Mueller, that's what was said before.
Bringing any charges against Trump. They never even let that do. We found out.
was right next to Trump. That was like a little speed bump right there. Just like, oh, okay, what's that? Tonight we got a new filing from that same former president. 12 was a federal court in Florida. The former president is asking for a special master to be appointed by the board to review the materials that the FBI recently seized from President Trump's home in Florida. Trump is also demanding that the FBI give back to him the materials that they seized from his home. Which is really something. I mean, you'll recall that among the statutes under which the former president is now being investigated are portions of the Espionage Act dealing with unauthorized retention of national security information that could harm the United States or involve a foreign adversary. Which means, dude, whatever happens, you're probably not going to get this stuff back. Not when that's what you will be investigating. The chairman of the House Intelligence Committee is going to be our guest tonight in just a few minutes. There's been a reporting today that he and other very senior members of Congress have asked to actually see the materials, the classified materials that Trump had taken and was hiding in his home before the FBI had to go in and take them back. We're going to ask him about that. We're also going to ask him about this brand new reporting that has just dropped from the New York Times. Headline, Trump had more than 300 classified documents at Mar-a-Lago. This is the Times for the first time quantifying the amount of reportedly classified material that Trump has apparently been keeping in his home in an unauthorized way. Here's the lead. The initial batch of documents retrieved by the National Archives from former President Trump in January include more than 150 documents marked as classified, a number that ignited intense concern of the Justice Department and helped trigger the criminal investigation that led FBI agents to swoop into Mar-a-Lago this month, seeking to recover more. In total, the government has recovered more than 300 documents with classified markings on them. From Mr. Trump, since he left office, that first batch of documents returned in January, then another set of documents from one of Trump's aides in June. And then also the materials seized by the FBI on the searches. Times also reports that following the search of Mar-a-Lago, investigators have since sought additional surveillance footage from the club. We knew that investigators had asked for surveillance tape before the search warrant was executed at Mar-a-Lago. We now know, according to the Times' reporting at least, that investigators have since sought additional surveillance tape of the time leading up to the August 8th search warrant execution. Quote, the tape revealed people moving boxes in and out, and in some cases, to change the containers that the documents were left in. The footage also showed other parts of the property, and seeking a second round of security footage, the Justice Department wants to review tapes for the weeks leading up to the August 8th search. But again, that's the Times reporting just within the past few minutes. For the first time, quantifying, at least according to the Times' reporting, the number of classified documents we're talking about. We have more than 300 documents being held by the former president at Mar-a-Lago, despite the fact that they were marked as classified. More than 150 of those documents, classified documents, being taken from Mr. Trump in January, more provided in June, and then yet more since by the FBI research. So we will ask the House Intelligence Committee chairman about all of that. We'll also try to get a take on these bizarre and murky plans of Moscow Kremlin. A far-right, and there's no better word for him, a far-right fascist philosopher, this man, Alexander Dugin, who has been a major influence on Vladimir Putin. He's one of Russia's top intellectual cheerleaders for Russia's 30s recent wars in Ukraine and Georgia. A cheerleader for Russia seizing territory from other countries. This man is credited with giving Putin his arguments and his stupid intellectual justification for invading neighboring countries and trying to reconstitute some kind of transnational Russian empire. Alexander Dugin, his daughter, was reportedly murdered in a car bomb assassination in a rich neighborhood outside Moscow this weekend. Now, nobody quite knows what to believe about these reports, other than the fact that, just like clockwork, just as you expect, Russia blamed Ukraine for the death and citing that killing as all the justification they need for some kind of new escalation, some kind of new ruthlessness they're going to bring to bear on the war in Ukraine. Again, I think caution is the There's no more here. It's not clear what has happened. There's no reason to trust the Russian government in this any more than we trust anybody else. But as Putin's war in Ukraine just turned 6 months old this week, it does seem like this dark, murky, weird insult, this war forming assassination, might be priming us for some worrying behavior from Putin and Russian forces in the days ahead, potentially in Ukraine, potentially elsewhere in Russia's borders. We'll talk with the intelligence community chairman about that. Screen should give us as well in just a few minutes. Our first guest tonight, pleased to say, somebody who has no parallel at all, is a singular figure in American public service, in a good way. Somebody who spent 38 years in one of the most important and most difficult jobs in American public life. Somebody who has drawn criticism a lot of it because his focus work is high stakes, it is often controversial, challenging, personal. But for all that he's been through in his decades of public life, he has never before now been able to have a security detail protect him all the time because of the death.
Oh, my favorite topic, Trump and Fauci. How did you know MSNBC?
This was a fatal disease.
No one did it well. Dr. Fauci, you're killing us.
Dr. Fauci was...
That was a sign like from probably 1970s.
He was the target of big, urgent, 80s. Spectacular protests.
Flares.
And while he was being targeted by racism, he had the
interest... So DC kills people.
...to listen.
That's amazing.
And to realize CDC's that his killing women. Were actually right.
It's good to be here.
That not only did clinical trials...
Black and white photo.
...need to be sped up, people's lives would
you want
say
time
needed to be able to get access to drugs
that yeah, that's interesting. That was finally the conclusion that I came to, right?
They did not have
the
time
CDC
to wait,
is,
and they should not be
is corrupt.
It was very,
you know, I
very
think in America we tend to keep listening to people when they tell us the truth, even if they're full of shit sometimes.
And
I tend to stop listening to people after they're full of shit one time. And so that's what makes us different.
How many other people?
But could truth
do that?
Is
that a. Dr. Anthony Fauci has now spent 38 years as the head of NIAID.
Truth calls.
Visible and active leader in the nation's response to infectious diseases of all kinds. He took your names to the ones we don't necessarily know.
Fauci was fantastic for the media because the media loves giving people a reason to continue tuning in. And he would speak with urgency and authority, and he'd be all conservative, and he was big on vaccines. He basically lied when he told people to avoid the masks in the beginning so the workers would get them.
People who
They should have shut it down sooner, and they should have encouraged alternative therapies and not been so into vaccines, as they still are. Because after a while, I stopped listening to them. It was just hounding and manipulation and all kinds of pressure from mainly liberal idiots trying to make everybody get vaccinated into like shit if they don't. But I think I caught it early on before it was even out. Was it back in January 2020? So I don't think I caught it again, and I was never afraid of it. Yeah, a lot of what they did or tried to do lately totally had the opposite effect on me. It happens a lot. You know, I can sense or feel pressure from the media or the government to act, feel, or be a certain way. I say, what? Well, why? And I figure out what I think about it, and then I decide how I want to be. But some things, and sometimes they don't let things go. Sometimes they don't let things go. They just keep hounding people to no end forever and ever, and day in, day out. But these shows are interesting because I've noticed that some of them are like this kind of stuff, where they just fill it up with like Trump and Fauci and whatever. And then some shows on CNN actually do cover like news stories. Maddow sometimes covers a news story like that you wouldn't hear normally about the environment or maybe minority rights or something like that. Flint, Michigan stuff with the water there. But she's broken some interesting stories to me, but sometimes she's one of those types that just focuses in on a couple of, you know, kind of partisan overarching stories, whether it's Clinton's or whoever. It's interesting hearing people talk about whoever they're enamored with or whoever they respect. They always talk about them in a positive light, whoever it is. But when it comes back from commercial, I'm going to jam again. You can find this whole live file on my website later. I was going to broadcast on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, but this is only on Facebook and Instagram. And later on my website and YouTube.
accomplished researcher who has helped lead our country through public health crises of all stripes.
I don't mention it.
The
party for me,
I'll kill you. The top infectious diseases doctor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said today, stepping down by the end of this year, ending his decades long career in public life. He says he's looking forward to his next chapter this coming summer.
Certainly when my friends called me a doctor at my reunion for a doctorate degree, I said, yeah, but I only talked about, that's only in religious circles that I use that degree. It was a religious high school, but still, I don't know. I'm not used to using it. Oh my God, Fauci. Could have retired about a decade ago.
You know, with a great deal of honor to do that, to be his chief medical advisor, I thought that was going to last 1 year because, like so many other people,
he's in his 80s. Most people retire in their 70s.
At the end of the first year of the Biden administration, but obviously it's not.
But not everybody.
So, having said that, some things look like they're starting to stabilize a bit.
And as lifespans increase, maybe people start.
Again, I'm
still working longer.
Because I want to
some people
want to
increase
the energy,
Social Security, how many years it takes before you get Social Security.
To do the kind of things that I want to do. So, all things considered, actually, I thought it was the right time.
There are very few people
me too,
who serve in government who, when you hear they're going to write a book, you think, oh, good, I'll probably write something about it. No offense to public officials who are not.
I would have preferred to have somebody else. I don't like. I didn't get captured by Fauci or Cuomo the way some people did. Some people were glued to the television day and night, scared shitless over COVID, and he was like their God and their savior. Yeah, I just treated him pretty much like a normal person. That I got sick of hearing every single day and refused to listen to every single day. And then only had one idea, one way, kind of like maybe my dad or somebody would imply a solution. This is the way, this is the best way. You don't gotta do it, but you should do it, and we're gonna do it, and this is how it's gonna be. We're probably from the same generation, of course.
I think it's a mixed bag, Richard.
Not to mention, I think that there was a giant bias by Fauci and people in his age and demographic against young people during the pandemic. And the government's chosen path, I think, leaned heavily towards being conservative and favoring old people instead of favoring young people.
To emerging
infection, looking at this as a real long-term thing, as like something they want to knock out and stop immediately after they had it run rampant. This is how a capitalist country that's, you know, big pharma is, has its teeth into runs a pandemic response. U.S. is suffering from a pandemic response. It has for a long time, not the pandemic.
Of HIV back in the early 80s when I first got involved and the first cases were recognized.
Big Pharma has lobbies and they want everybody getting an injection and tons of them. They want people listening to them about when they should get their next one and how their kids should get them and on. They're thrilled about all this.
For forced us to adapt and to change.
So being an American capitalist in the 21st century and partisans made them fight this a certain way. And both of these parties, I think, did a terrible job and continue to do so to this day.
Is that we've got to be prepared. We've got to be able to respond, but we've also got to be...
It's erratic, it's inconsistent, it's late.
Military colleagues have told us it's kind of like...
Dyslexic.
You can plan what you're going to do, but when the bullets...
Too little, too late. And not enough for long enough.
And you've got to be flexible enough to respond. I hope that that lesson...
Yeah, I don't know. It probably could have been a whole lot worse. But the country is still suffering from a lot of that response. This recession is probably a direct result of it. And 114 24-hour fitness gyms closed, and once today's reopening. And there's all kinds of people that are out of work and that have different jobs now or whatever. Not to mention inflation.
Is there an increased pace of threat from new and resurgent viruses?
As far as I'm concerned, there's a possibility that some of the economic problems are either partisan or from a world power, enemy world power, or both. Because it's real strange, mysterious economic problems start to pop their heads up when Democrats get in office. And the Republicans always say that they're better at economics, and then things suddenly always kind of smooth out when the Republicans are in office when it comes to the economy. Unless they don't respond to a pandemic.
And we're seeing that this historic pandemic, the pandemic of COVID-19, which almost certainly evolved when we saw it in London, from an animal reservoir such as a bat in the environment that jumps species. So if we really want to pay attention to how we can mitigate this, we have to pay much more attention to the animal-human interface and to what we are doing intentionally or inadvertently of perturbing the animal-human interface by encroaching upon rainforests, by getting involved in interfacing with animals, such as in the wet markets which occur in China when you bring in animals where you don't have any idea what disease they're operating and put them in close touch with humans. I think that's one of the things we really better pay more attention to looking forward, is attention to that animal-human interface.
There have been a lot of theories and conspiracy theories and accusations and more or less wild claims about the origins of COVID in particular.
Yeah, U.S. is not with you with monkeypox because it's not so bad or widespread that they need to shut things down. It's not so bad, deadly, or communicable that they can sell tons of vaccines because it's not as big a threat. It's not being spread like the other ones. So it's kind of a...
criticism before.
I don't know.
It does feel a little different. There is a weird, obsessive, violent...
If Big Pharma is going to profit off of monkeypox, they're going to have to direct treatments to people that are highly likely to get it and forget everybody else, pretty much. Because if everybody else is going to forget about it. So the high-risk groups they mentioned is... It's going to be there only people if they sell it.
It's
a little bit like AIDS and HIV medicines,
it's
I think. At least at first. It was primarily in the gay communities.
And you showed some of those clips, which were quite accurate. What we were doing in the federal government, when we were being too rigid and restrictive in a disease that needed a great deal of flexibility and input from the community, the AIDS activists that you saw on the clips that you showed, we examined what they were saying and what they were asking for. They were entirely correct. So they opened our eyes, my eyes particularly, which made me...
But, you know, this monkeypox continuing in the news and people get worried and it goes, the government ends up... writing checks to Big Pharma for monkeypox vaccinations for some people, I think. Or at least that's on the table.
It's just a distortion of reality, Rachel.
You know, people that can't afford it and high risk groups and what have you.
Pushing back on sound public health measures.
So whether it's a serious risk or not.
Is encroaching on people's freedom. That's a big difference.
They might find someone to get a payday.
Who really had a good foundation for their
objections. Getting paid off of fear.
Do you have any insight into what we ought to do as a country to deal with that? I mean, I feel like it's part of what's going on in the right, where, you know, you want to sort of separate the politics from reality, that you want the measure of truth to be what the ruler says is true, and so everybody studying science or facts or objective reality or nuance is by definition the enemy. And I feel like it is tied to politics in some ways.
Fauci, man,
you know,
was...
observations like that doesn't necessarily...
I blame the media more than Fauci, because Fauci was one voice that the media chose to focus on. The media could have played 50% Fauci and 50% Joe Rogan if they wanted to. But they didn't. They gave Fauci the entire time, unabated, unchallenged. So if people hate Fauci, they should blame the media. Because they're the people that wouldn't listen to anybody else or let us hear anybody else. And I got sick of hearing the same guy sing the same damn song. And I knew that there's other voices out there and other options. So I just stopped. I turned it off. I stopped listening. You know, it just got to the point where these liberal Democrat news... MSM, mainstream, liberal mainstream media stations, were just day in, day out, just drilling you about vaccines. And it was pretty comical, almost. Yeah. It's like, I don't know what was going on in their head, but I imagine they were just thinking, like, oh, you just got to get more people vaccinated, like, every single day. And they treated it like a crusade, like a religious crusade, like they were getting paid. Commission to just get people vaccinated. It was like their dying wish, like their passion. Everybody knew it was best for everybody, and they had to tell everybody all day, every day, every hour. It was really, really a shit show. They shouldn't have done that to people. To us, to America.
Service. I can't wait to see what you do next, and thank you for being here to talk with us about it tonight. Thank you
for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, that's it.